I'm going to ask that our speakers come up, and we're going to arrange the chairs up here. Now, we have a time limit on this, but so we can't probably get all the questions, but please turn them in. They're going to come down and pick up the questions from you on the inside of the aisles, and then I want these our speakers to come up if they would. Let me. Some of you, if this is your first time here, you won't know, so let me let you do it so people can identify you. So Dr. Del Tackett, if you'll come up, and then Dr. Steve Austin, who was with us, and then Thomas Purifoy, the maker of the film. Where are you, Thomas? So, if y'all, while we're pulling these, all these questions together, I mean, I want you to stop and say, you watched and you heard, here's a volcano. You saw what happened. You saw the effect, the catastrophic effect, what you would normally think. Let me give it to you my way of thinking. So I've got a faucet in the backyard that's dripping. And at the end of the day, I go and look and say, oh, the dripping faucet eroded an inch of water. And then I come back the next day and it erodes another inch of water. Of course, I know you're going to say, fix the faucet. Okay. I can't get the plumber out there. So I come back the third day, another inch of water is gone. I come back the next day and another inch of soil is gone. I come back the next day, a foot is gone. Did I lose 10 days? Or did somebody cut the water off? And the force of the faucet, instead of an inch a day, now in one day, because of the force of the faucet, now it's something totally different. So when they say from the theory of uniformitarianism, all is as it ever has been, then Peter says, but this effect escapes our notice. Number one is creation. Number two is the flood. And then you have events like Sodom and Gomorrah. And those are all very significant events. So you've just heard this wonderful, for me, captivating. I wish that I had you in the 10th grade, Dr. Austin. I might have done just a little better. But here this captivating thing. Now, I want you to stop and think as we understand what happened in the flood. I don't know how many hundreds of those things took place at one time. As the deep is opened up and the valleys become mountains and the mountains become valley, not just one up there. Yellowstone's even bigger than that one. But now just think of scores upon scores upon scores upon scores. And then think of what happened in the recovery of that period afterwards. It's just an extraordinary thing that you have to understand, the authority of the inerrancy of God's word. So, gentlemen, if y'all will take a seat. Thomas, you came. That's good. I'm glad to see that. Good. Yeah. All right, guys, I want to address to y'all some questions, if I can. And we have some here, and I'm looking so forward to getting your answers to these. So here we go. Here's the first one. So why don't we find human and dinosaur fossils together? All right, because they've been on the ark together. Why don't we find the fossils together? Which one of you guys want to start?
I'll take that one, the geologist. But what we don't find shouldn't really bother us. It's what we do find that as scientists we should be really concerned about. But there's lots of things we haven't found, but it seems like dinosaurs and humans didn't exist in the same ecology area very much. Despite what Flintstones and animation tells us about dinosaurs, they probably were largely in another habitat. Anyway, the flood came and killed all of the sea creatures first. Then it got to the land mammals and eventually man. There's not a lot of human artifacts directly related to the flood. And the stated purpose of the flood was to destroy man and the works of man from the face of the earth. And that's Genesis chapter 6. So it's not surprising we don't find much pre-flood man. And we do find a lot of dinosaurs, though.
Okay.
That would be my way to go on that. And
you can turn this on. This one? Yeah. Well, you can quote Kurt Wise, too, who likes to double down on that. It's not just humans that are missing, but it's also all modern mammals and also all flowering plants and angiosperms. So he points out, and he's a paleontologist, he likes to, his, again, idea is that there's a whole biome missing. And it's not just one thing, it's a lot of things. And so one of the arguments he makes, and it's curious, is that this biome may have just disappeared and been sucked down under the mantle, I think is what one of his arguments, and that it seems that it wasn't, so far as we've found so far, it was not fossilized. So there's a lot of things missing. It's a curious question. I think it's a curious problem. We talk about this in our Beyond is Genesis history. Marcus Ross discussed this, a paleontologist, that you would think you would find this, but what's strange is just how many things that are missing. And that seem to live together today. So his argument is that the whole thing, when God said he'd wipe it out, he literally wiped it out. And there is no trace of it. Okay. But it's an idea.
All right. So you're not going to get off. I've got one for you. So can you expand on your statement this morning? The day is coming when the theory of evolution is a thing of the past. Let me try to remember. Did you say that, or did you say naturalism I couldn't remember, but go ahead.
Well, actually, what I said was that I believe that the current scientific paradigm will collapse in the same way we've seen paradigms in the past collapse. And the reason for that is because the evidence against a set of random processes producing what we continue to see is more exquisite, more complex systems within, for example, the inner cell. That at some point, I think one could assume that holding on to that notion is going to collapse. Now, the question is, what would replace it? Certainly today we're not in a position where I think any kind of a biblical Christian paradigm would replace it. I think Dr. Francis Crick kind of gives us an idea of what might replace that. If you recall, Francis Crick and Watson were the co-discoverers of DNA. And as they began to look for really the first time, from a scientific and human perspective, look at the first time at the deep complexity of DNA and RNA and the whole process of the replication that the cell goes through, and recognizing in essence the millions and millions of lines of computer code that are represented in the DNA, and the mechanisms that were necessary to then use that information to replicate the cell, that Dr. Crick first of all recognized there was not enough time in order for random processes to bring about that deep complexity. But instead of Dr. Crick turning to the true historical record of how all of this was made, Dr. Crick offered his naturalistic theory, and that is that it came from outer space. He called it directed panspermia. And so, I mean, I don't really know, and I don't know if it will even collapse in our lifetime, but I believe that it is increasingly difficult for that paradigm to close its eyes and ears against the mounting evidence of design and exquisite design in the universe around us. And it is possible that what would reshape that would be an acceptance of design, but the design comes from outer space. Of course, that just puts the, you know, that just puts the problem off somewhere else. That's all it does. And one then would ask, well, then how did it come about from somewhere else? So that's what I said today.
So to answer the question, is Genesis history, in a nutshell, to a skeptic or Darwinian evolutionist, is Genesis history, what would be a elevator speech to give to someone?
I think Paul did a good job of it to the Athenians. And so I think when you look at that, he started looking at the creation and just observed what he saw about it and said, clearly there's a creator, and Genesis tells about it. So that's worth a quick one, is to take a cue from the Apostle Paul.
Okay. Anybody else? All right. So who were the people that Cain was so worried about in Genesis 4:14?
This is a fun one. Do you want me to? So this is interesting. If you look at when, obviously, God is about to curse Cain, he's nervous about other people. The question is, what age did Cain kill Abel? And so this is interesting. I would say this is called the felt board mistakes that we all fall into, or the child storybook, that we grow up, get the child storybook, seeing Adam and Eve and Cain and Abel, and they paint a picture of Cain and Abel being young. But if you think about it, if you're working off of the Masoretic text, then basically Adam was 130 when he had Seth. And if you're working off the Septuagint, it's at least 230. So what it would tell you is that that's 130 years at least that you've had children and people. And so what it is very interesting, who these people are very likely are Abel's children and relatives. And Cain is very worried about blood guilt because he will become, and they will come and find him, and they will kill him for having killed the patriarch of their family. And so that's actually what is missed is just that little bitty point that Eve says, you know, he's given me a child to replace Abel. And so that's what I would argue. It's there in the text. Very clearly that there were many more people living at that time. They were much older when he killed him.
And there was no real restriction by God in terms of marrying a cousin or even a sister. Those laws were not given until much, much later. It is possible one could say that because of the genetic purity early on, there wasn't a problem associated with marrying someone that close. The kind of genetic problems that we know today as a result of having our genome decay over that period of time, it does cause a problem. But it was not unlawful for that to happen. And so they married sisters and cousins. And
so y'all understand that, right? The laws of incest don't come into the Mosaic law. And so when that's put in place, then for various reasons we won't go into, but that's put in place until then. For instance, Abraham married his, when he tells Pharaoh and Abimelech that's his sister, he was halfway right. She was his half-sister. And you have the same incestuous issue that we would later call incest through the Mosaic law that actually governed Moses' parents would have been not been able to get married after Moses wrote the Mosaic law, because that would have been considered incest. So Jochebed and Amram. So that's what he's saying. So yeah, you got that 100+ years, and you got people. He's not recording every birth in the book of Genesis, but clearly births are going on. And you don't have a government that steps in, okay, send the FBI, find out about this, you know, bring CSI, who killed who in the field. That's not going to happen. Word goes out, and family took care of it. You know, some of y'all live in the South, you know. I mean, most families have an Uncle George and a Cousin Ralph, and you don't want them to visit you. And so that's what, you know, Cain's pretty worried about that. And so I think that's your answer. Yeah, well done. So here we go. Let's see. And I'm sorry, I should have been ahead of myself here. In the movie on Saturday night, it was stated that the Neanderthal man was human. According to DNA, the Neanderthal man has a different DNA number than humans. Can you explain? All right.
You want me to do it? Or you, want to do it? You do it.
Yeah. So the Neanderthal DNA it's called paleo genetics, but it was actually resequenced, I believe, by a Scandinavian. I can't remember the guy's name. And it was interesting about it when he resequenced the DNA, because they had to kind of pull it together. It was a real shocker for most evolutionists. And there's actually, he wrote a book on this and talked about it, saying that, well, actually, it's very, very close to humans, which is not what any evolutionist thought. In fact, I remember actually hearing a few evolutionists say it kind of stunned them, because the problem is that Neanderthals were supposed to be somewhat separate, and this would have put humans and Neanderthals interrelating. Well, it's interesting, the guy at the end of the book, he kind of had a little postscript, and he said everybody shot him down. Evolutionists, old Earth creation, everybody said this can't be the case, except for young Earth creationists. And he pointed out the young Earth creationists actually had adopted this view already, because there's the assumption that there were many different types of humans that were around the Earth, and because of the catastrophic nature post-flood, you had them living in fairly diverse and difficult situations. And so Neanderthal would have just been those that were living in Europe and other parts of the Israel and other parts of the world that basically would have eventually kind of been incorporated or died off, that part of their DNA is still incorporated into Homo sapiens. And in fact, you can sometimes see people that look a lot like Neanderthals.
Okay, guys, you ready?
Yes.
So here you go. Ready? Softball. What do you think about climate change?
Okay. Well, I'm the earth scientist, right, on the staff. Let me say, I've learned about agenda-driven science through my career. I was on San Francisco television when I was 8 years old with scientists. For 3 years, I learned how to talk to people and get their interest or interested in talking to me through science. And when I was 18 years old, I got a NSF stipend to go study with a PhD student glacial geology in Colorado, in Boulder, Colorado. And I learned about climate agenda as people were talking about it then. The glaciers were melting off and some things. And so I took advantage of the of agenda-driven science during my PhD program. You may have figured it out. I got a PhD thesis project that was fully funded by the federal government. When? During the energy crisis, when we need to define what? Cleaner coal and that type of thing. And so I got good at talking to people about things that would keep their interest, and even government administrators and things like that. And then I started learning about the global warming agenda, and it's an agenda. There's what, $4 billion a year spent on climate research, something like that. I think it's overstated, but some things about global warming are true. Like, for example, it has been global warming. There's a little bit of global warming evidence, and there's a little bit of CO2 increase in the atmosphere. But that it's anthropogenic driven, that part is very shaky. And Michael Mann at Penn State University had the office next door to me on the fifth floor of Dyke Building. And so I was familiar with what was being talked about. And I think that the man-caused part of global warming has been overstated. Now, there's probably a small minor cause, man, but it would have a man cause, but it would have warmed anyway. We're coming out of the most glaciated epoch of the warmest interglacial of the most glaciated epoch in Earth history. Okay, and so it's got to warm, and I think that the effects of global warming have been spun a different way, and so. Probably human caused. I think that's incorrect. And my personal belief is that global greening has occurred, and maybe that's not as bad as we think it is. If it was global cooling, I would be more concerned about it, because there's all kinds of third world diseases like typhus and bubonic plague that are caused by global cooling, and global warming actually has been the case. Well, since 1880, the eruption of Krakatoa 40 years ago, that whole event and it's been warming. So the warming trend is there. And I don't think the statements that were made by the ICCP about what will happen in the next 35 years, like all of the glaciers in the Himalayas were melting off or something like that, will be true. So I would say, yes, there has been a warming trend, and it's been global greening as well, and so there's lots of advantages to that. And it's been beneficial for human society, not having the cold weather diseases like typhus and plague and cholera, those kind of diseases, and that now we're looking back on that. So that'd be my case. There's a book by Matt Ridley called, maybe you've heard of Matt Ridley. He's a British author, and he wrote a book called The Rational Optimist. Okay, and he wants to write a book against the rational pessimist. And he thinks that the world is full of rational pessimists, like people that talk about global warming. And so he wrote his book, The Rational Optimist, and talked about how history has been beneficial to the terrestrial ecosystems, and even how global greening has occurred because of the warm trend that we're in. So very interesting subject, but agenda-driven science. Okay, and that's the trouble with science. It's getting agenda-driven. When it's agenda-driven, the ultimate agenda-driven science has never been really critiqued well by the establishment. And what is that? Evolution, right? That's an agenda as well. So those are where you might go with the subject.
I had a very interesting discussion with a gentleman several years ago who is a solar physicist from China. And he had been invited to a conference in which they were taking a number of burning issues in the culture today, and they had a debate between the two different sides on each of these issues. And I was a part of that on one issue. And then one issue that was being debated was the issue of global warming. And this Chinese solar physicist was on the negative side,
and then there was a Harvard physicist on the positive side. And so I watched the debate. I was very interested in his in the things that he was saying, and had a chance to have dinner with him and go into more depth. But in essence, in his presentation, he said this, that if you study the fluctuations in the solar system, they're very consistent among the planets, and there and those fluctuations. And I would agree with Dr. Austin that from the standpoint of coming off of the Ice Age, which was pretty much the result of the flood and the heated oceans, it's pretty much the only way you can get an Ice Age. Most people think an Ice Age comes because it just gets cold. But if it gets real cold, if for any of those who live up north, you get real cold, you don't, it doesn't, there's no precipitation. And so you had to have this very, very unique situation of very, very warm oceans, extremely warm oceans, and then the polar cooling, which is what we had after the flood. And therefore we get the Ice Age. But from that perspective, the Earth has been warming up. Those ice sheets have been melting for ever since that Ice Age. But the solar physicist said there are fluctuations in the temperatures of the solar system, and the Earth is affected by those fluctuations as well. He said if you look and study the relationship between temperature and carbon dioxide, and he said he'd done extensive study on that, that the temperature curve always leads the carbon dioxide curve. And so that as temperature rises as a result of solar activity, as temperature rises, there is a trailing rise in carbon dioxide. Well, that's the exact opposite of what we are told. Carbon dioxide produces a rise in temperature. But his position was, no, that's not true. That's if you look at physical artifacts that we can study in ice and rocks and all of the other things that they do, that that's not how it happens. And anyway, so he told this story. He said that he had produced a number of these graphs as a result of his research. And he said there was a U.S. textbook, and he showed it to us up on the screen. And he said, I was so delighted to see my research graph in the in this American textbook. Except as I looked at it, they had flipped the curves. And they showed the carbon dioxide rising first, followed by temperature. And so he said, this bothered me. And so I wrote to the publisher, and I said, thank you very much for using my research. However, you have erroneously or mistakenly flip those the notations on this curve. And then he showed us the letter he got back from the publisher that said, in essence, he said, no, we believe that the narrative properly describes what is going on. And so this Chinese solar physicist stopped and he said, so, he said, I learned something very important. In America, global warming is not a science issue, it is a political issue. And so I've never forgotten that.
So, guys, let me just give you this is the lightning round. We'll just ask all three of you to answer this. So, what arguments do you face most often in opposition to the young Earth, six-day creation, and the catastrophic impact of the flood?
I mean, just very quickly, I would say, and Steve may jump into this, I mean, there's so many areas that young Earth creationists, most people don't realize how few scientists there are working on stuff, but most people would agree the astronomical work has been the least done. And Danny Faulkner has said this, that there just hasn't been enough development in a biblical cosmology. And so I think that the questions of why there are the redshifts, the nature of starlight, I mean, there are a number of arguments, but I don't think it's, everyone would say it hasn't been effectively answered. I think there's a lot of research that hasn't been talked about, most people don't know about. Mm-hmm. What else do you think, Steve?
I would say what comforts me and challenges me most is not the problems that people ask me to solve. It's the ones that we've already solved. Okay, and some of those issues are really interesting, and to see how people deal with some of these issues. For example, a Coconino sandstone in the Grand Canyon, it's down below the rim of the Grand Canyon, about a third of the way down or a quarter of the way down. That 350-foot thick white sandstone, cream-colored layer, has been thought to have been deposited in a desert.
and it was like the Energizer Bunny or the battery on the shoulder, I dare you to knock it off, that kind of thing. People were saying that obviously wasn't deposited by a flood. It was deposited by wind in a desert. Okay, and that's not a flood deposit in Grand Canyon. No, there have got to be two floods minimum to make Grand Canyon. And then what, over the years, 30 years we've been studying this, we've seen that the Coconino sandstone is best interpreted as a water-deposited sand. And characteristics of the cross-bedding, the texture of the sandstone, many of the class in the sandstone, dolomite class, rounding, the texture being unsorted, and things that make it quite different than desert, make a strong case that that's deposited underwater. And so some of the hardest problems that you think could never be solved are sometimes very easily solved. And that's so what other problems do we have that we need to solve? Let's talk about those. So but that's what's good about creation science is we're able to solve problems and see problems and solve them as they come along.
And there's a need for young scientists to come out to start working on these. And so I think that's probably the second, just the people that Christians interested in science, it's a great thing to be involved in.
Okay. Dale.
Well, by far the number one question that is raised to me is the starlight issue. I think by far people are bothered by that, and I try to talk to them about that, and they're not always satisfied.
Okay. All right. Well, I'm not satisfied either. And praise the Lord, I get to come back tomorrow night. And so Dell will be speaking on a very non-controversial subject, the age of the Earth. And that'll be tomorrow night. And we're going to have another Q&A. And so we're going to go through, Bruce and I are going to go through these. And we're going to try to categorize them so your question gets answered in the category, if at all possible, tomorrow night. And we'll be starting at 6 o'clock. The Children's Conference continues at the same time. And so we're looking forward to having, and then we'll have our forum back. We'll have our Q&A, and with the same pattern as we did tonight, all right? So we're looking forward to that. See you tomorrow night. We've got to work through these. You say, Pastor, are you going to get through all of these? Probably not, but Eric Reibels and Bruce Stallings are going to handwrite the answers to all of these that we don't cover. We're going to give them a two-week period of time to respond to that. Handwritten notes to all of you. But we're going to do our best to get as many of these questions tomorrow night. And we'll give you a chance for some others as well. So let me close in prayer. Thank you for being with us tonight. Would you join me in thanking our speakers and their work here? So, Father, I thank you so much for your grace and your mercy that's found in Christ. The reality is that this is a lot of joy to be able to try to think biblically of origins, who we are, where did we come from, why are we here, what has happened in the history of humanity, what is history, and the fact that Genesis is history. But we also realize that ultimately the issue with humanity is not the problem with the mind, but the problem with the heart, and that we suppress the truth of unrighteousness. So, Spirit of the living God, would you do your work to enable us to communicate truth in love, with clarity and winsomely, give your people a hunger to learn truth, and then give us the ability, Father, to communicate that in a way that you go before us by your Spirit and give to men and women hearts to hear and see. And that glorious truth is the same one who brought this into existence for his own glory, is the one who gave his Son that we might be saved from falling short of glory and utter death and destruction for eternity into the life of a new heavens and a new earth. We give you praise and thanksgiving through Jesus our Lord. Amen.